Hey everybody, today I'm joined by Jerry Ying, who's a director, producer, and actor, and he is the co-founder, is it, Jerry, of Hero LA, or are you the direct
co-founder. No, co-founder I founded with two others.
Perfect. That was an amazing intro. How are you doing, buddy? You all right?
I'm doing great, man.
Awesome. Thank you for joining
me. Glad to be here.
My pleasure for having you on, and I had Jeremy on a few weeks ago, month ago, I think, and
Jeremy Gordon, the man himself,
talking about quarantine, which you guys, well, quarantine, the actual act of doing it, and also, I guess, quarantine in terms of the show you guys did, which was the kind of hookup with yourself, and that must seem like a long time ago now for you guys.
That feels like years ago, when in reality, we just wrapped like 6-7 weeks ago. Yeah, we live in dog years at this point.
Yeah, I keep telling people, and anyone who listens will probably get really sick of me saying this again, but I don't care. It feels like a Christopher Nolan movie to me because the sense of time.
Yeah, you know, that's horrible because I also have this sense about Nolan that he cannot bring home a story properly. I have the sense that...
Well, then it's even more poignant based on how you perceive it.
Which makes me worry. We are in a Christopher Nolan film. Oh my God. At least it's beautiful, right?
Sort of, yeah, I guess. It looks nice, maybe, perhaps. I don't know. I mean, who shot it? Was it Deacons? Because Deacons shot this.
If Deacons shot it, then we all look amazing, right?
We all look amazing, but our heads are spinning and we don't know our ass from our elbow.
Exactly.
So, I mean, I spoke to Jeremy about quarantine and got his take, but it'd be cool to maybe get your take a little bit on that experience. You know, I know it was big for you guys to be first out the gate, to be sort of the ones that could say we did this first, but maybe from a director producer point of view, how was that for you?
There was no real sense from my end about we have to be first. Okay. It was more like once we realized we were locked down, we started slowly shutting down, realizing that all the things we had going, all the business I had generated post Sundance was basically to have to go away. But we were committed. I remember having a meeting at Hero being like, let's work harder through this than anyone. Let's come out of this running. At the time, I thought it was like 2 months, 3 months. In my mind, let's bust our butts for the next 2-3 months. Little did I know, it's literally going to be the entire year. But we had that conversation. And you know, it was the first, as it was for most people, real pause in everyone's life. As long as I can remember, except for when I was an actor, which meant like I was always on pause. Life was great. When I'm working. Outside of that, it was like, you know, you had some time to think about things. But at Hero, for 4 years, I've either been directing or producing everyone else's things, happily. But it's, you know, you don't have time for your own sort of creative because, you're not paying yourself, number one. But two, those projects, those passion projects, take up a lot of time. And when I get into something like that, it's everything. And the last thing I did was kind of what transitioned me from acting to what I do now was I wrote and directed a series called We Are Fathers that sort of launched me into literary, you know, and all of a sudden I had a rep at Paradigm and Untitled, and next thing I was writing. But that took everything. And so this pause, and I've been itching, you know, when your mind is always thinking in terms of stories and creative, you're always just thinking of ideas like, oh, I'd love to make that someday, or I'd love to, or you find, and for me, it always comes from humor. I always like, oh, that would be really funny, or this would be a really funny idea. And so that first little pause when we actually went to lockdown, I just started thinking about what type of stories I wanted to tell. And then I got the crazy notion of trying to do it like a soap, like I'll just give out a little piece and deliver every week content like a soap does, not make a soap, but do it like a soap. And that launched me into probably the hardest work I've ever done in the last 4 years, which was basically show running quarantine, 12, 14 hours a day, 6 days a week, easy.
And I'm assuming it was made even harder because of just the fact that it's this whole new world where you have logistical challenges of doing this remotely.
Ash, it was a total shit show. Like no one knew, it was all new. It was new medium, no one gets to meet, pre-production, fully remote. Like I was only using Zoom to drink with friends. We were not trying to like produce any. And by the way, that's kind of the inception of the whole quarantine story was, first of all, we were locked down. how do I make something where no one meets? Originally, it was going to be small crew, but it just stopped feeling less and less safe. And as a producer, I couldn't put actors, even if they were friends in that position, and then bring it home to my house with my family.
Yeah.
But I was happy hour Zooming a lot, and I was connecting with friends from all walks of life, and it was genuine. And so that's when the whole idea was like, I'll do it on Zoom. And then followed by that was the idea of, all right, it's an out of work cast from the show Fake Soap Chino Hills. And that's when I started laughing. I was like, oh,
there's now, the joke.
There's the joke. They get to be a little extra. My first two credits in television ever was All My Children. And I remember how batshit that experience was. And I was like, that gives us free reign to really have fun. And it also allows me to cast properly. Now I can go based on a set cast, patriarch, matriarch, who the kids are. Everyone can be hot. You know what I mean? Everyone's a little extra. And then it was just, that was sort of how it all came together really quickly. And then first call was to Spencer Garrett, you know, and Spencer was working with Jeremy. And so we had a producing team, and that's how we sort of started from there. Yeah.
And then, I mean, I know you had sort of arcs loosely for characters and shows that I guess were always evolving at the beginning, well, but.
We had characters and we had ideas of how we wanted. It was important for me to want to arc their stories. No one at the beginning of the quarantine was going to finish the same.
But you weren't planning at the start to go like, what was it, 50 eps or 60 eps or something?
No, like I said, I really thought it was going to be. The dream was, Ash, this was the dream. We shoot this series. We release, in my mind, if we're lucky, 20 episodes, and then we're out of the quarantine. We'll time it to right when we're out of this quarantine, and we move right into the single camera workplace show, stage, like the half hour, which yeah. means we go from this quarantine. The dream was to build a viral following around the world, because I remember saying everyone's using Zoom, and we go right to a streamer. Right out of this, we go right to the workplace environment. We established Chino Hills and their characters on Chino Hills and their relationships. And we moved right into a TV show and we're all famous. That was kind of the big plan.
And you know,
that wasn't the reason for it.
No, but you strategize about these things, which I guess comes in now with your role at Hero, where you're more looking from the creative macro top down view.
You learn. Yeah. You learn. You have to think about the business beforehand. But that can't be what drives it. And what actually drove it was the SAG-AFTRA Foundation, the COVID-19 Relief Fund. So
yes.
For a lot of reasons, I'd read an article that Netflix had donated $1 million to the COVID-19 Relief Fund. And I have been a SAG member for 20 years. I'm 20 years vested in the union. That's how I raised my family. And there was one year where I needed that help from the foundation. I remember writing in a letter to them, like, I hope to be able to repay this in some way someday. And so the reason, the show idea and the purpose for the show came together at the same exact time, because any show idea is a show idea, but I'm going to real actor friends for, like, how do you get people to motivate to want to do something for no money? Because we had no money. And it all sort of came together. I was like, well, this is why I want to do it, and this is what we want to do. And so those two pieces together really brought everyone on the team to work their butts off for 2.5-3 months. And so it never felt like, why are we doing it? The result was not important. The only important thing is that we were raising awareness for the foundation.
Yeah, it wasn't like self-gratuitous, just, look, we want to do something, look at us. It was more with a meaning behind it, which I think is really important, because first of all, like, what a great initiative with this project individually, but I guess generally with anything you do, just as a general mantra with work, like that idea of why the hell are you doing it? Whatever the project is super important, right?
It's the most important thing to me. My why, and I actually had this conversation with my daughter yesterday, but, and it was about school. You know, she was talking about how, like, history is boring. And I was like, look, right now you have to do certain things, but find your hook in. What is it about it? There's always an angle into something. And if you can't find that, then, well, then you're just out of luck. But we have a choice. You don't just have to suffer through that class, but we have a choice with every project that we do, or every project or film that I take on, or every artist that I work with. I need to know why I'm working with them. I need to know why I believe in this. And if I don't know that, and because you know how hard the work is for everything, and nothing happens quickly, nothing ever happens as planned, and nothing ever happens super smoothly. So you have to have, it's almost like a relationship, a romantic relationship. You have to have a reason why you're together in your head that you go through all the hard times together with.
That's important, isn't it? That's the thing. Because the why isn't like when it's feeling all good and rosy and unicorns, which is like once in a blue moon anyway. It's the days where you're like, oh, fuck, I don't really want to deal with this today. And then you have to remember like, well, hold on. It's actually hopefully a why that's bigger than you.
Yes, 100%. Sometimes that why could be money. The money is so incredible. Maybe you have to do it. You know, if you're fortunate, I guess you get to be in that position. But, you know, I would hope even then that's like, you still have to find a way to make it fun. Like nothing, you don't want to do it. I mean, we have one life to live. You know, there's no reason in like slinging through the mud, you know, and going through all that work every day. Then it's just like having a job you hate. And guess what? We're all artists. We didn't become artists for that purpose. You know, we did it so that we can enjoy what we do.
100%. 100%. That's a kind of an interesting possible segue, because obviously, you know, you spoke a little bit about the acting sort of start that you had, and then moving on to do Hero and obviously running that place and being a producer and a director. What was the motivation for you to transition from one to the, I mean, is it a full transition now? Do you just not act really anymore? Or is
it is. I don't, you know, it just kind of, I just don't have time to run around town. And there's enough mediocre work of me out there in the world that I actually have to work on my auditions hard to get them to a place. Like, I'm not one of those natural talents. Like, I always use the analogy that I'm like someone, like a golfer who picked up the game late in life. Like, my swing's a little awkward, but I can have a great three holes, and every once in a while I can have a great round. But it's not like I just show up and look amazing playing, you know, and play well. And I've worked with, I think part of the reason why I love what I do is I love being around incredibly talented people. And when I'm in scenes with them, I can always have that little piece in my head like, man, you were born to do this. But I didn't think about acting growing up. Never was on my mind. It's remarkable that I even ended up having a career that I'm super proud of. Like, I never had to have another job for the most part of my 20 years.
That's awesome.
So I'm super grateful for my career, but in a weird way, I was grateful for every job I got. I never felt entitled to anything because I didn't feel like one of these supremely talented actors that were born to do this. But I know that journey was incredibly important to me because it was my artist journey. And it's that journey that makes me the producer that I am, or the writer that I am. All of that happened because I went from, you know, I was going to go to medical school and I was a frat boy. From that guy to transition to becoming an artist, yeah, it required 20 years. You know what I mean? But no one had more fun doing it than me. I promise you that. I had a great, great 20 years.
It's a big transition. Did you go to medical school, or was that just...
I didn't. I was in graduate studies in New York. And like I said, I didn't transition. I didn't know why I left it. I knew that wasn't for me. You know, it's sort of like the immigrant story. These were my parents' dreams. And at that time, there are no Asian people on TV or film for them to believe that we had any shot of that as a career. It was all about being a doctor or a lawyer. And so I went from Michigan to Columbia. And while I enjoyed it, I was experiencing New York City for the first time, you know, and I remember being in Soho and I walked past this restaurant. It's going to sound ridiculous, but I was like, oh my God, the people eating here are so ridiculously hot and everyone working here is so ridiculously hot. I want to work here. And so I started waiting tables. I literally left all that to start waiting tables. But from that was the first seed of the journey. You know, that was, I'd been living in a bubble, I realized, you know, whereas at that restaurant, everyone I worked with and made friends with, you know, gay people, artists, single mothers, angry people, like that was my real education to the world. No one cared about what university you went to or what your major was, like, so not important. It was just, who are you and what are you trying to do in life? And so that was the beginning of it. And that actually opened the doors towards entertainment for me.
Makes sense. It was a social education, I guess, for lack of a better term. And I think it's interesting. I can relate. My dad was from Iran, although I don't speak Farsi and anything like that. But growing up in a Western country, but having that kind of culture, even though he left young, there was still that imprint that he carried, which is just organic from that part of the world, which is to your point. You, like, academics is everything. You don't have a choice. And literally it's like doctor, it's a joke I used to make with him all the time. Doctor, lawyer, like you got to do one of those things. Yeah. And you know, I think I was lucky that even though it was tough, when I kind of said, no, I want to be an actor, he embraced it, but it was having done what you did, already getting the degree in a totally different discipline. I was like, look, I did your thing, but it don't feel right. And I got to explore my own path. You know what I mean? And it sounds like a similar sort of aspect for you, sort of finding your own journey and having that own freedom. And I don't want to say control because I don't like the word, but you were manifesting your own path for yourself.
Yeah. Or like making yourself available to figure out what it is. You know, I don't even think I told my parents. I didn't. They had no clue. But you know what? When you don't ask your parents for money, you're good. Like, you graduate, you go. And I remember having this thought of like, because when you're in school, I was on their dime. You know, the way Asian parents express love is we pay for your education. And it's a legitimate one. Like, you're speaking, like, you know, a surefire way to sort of at least give your children a shot is to give them an education. And there'll be jobs available. But I remember having that thought and being like, well, if I don't ever, then I'll be good. You know, if I don't have to meet them for lunch to ask for money, then I'm good. You know, I just got to go get a job. And so the acting worked out. Next thing you know, you're showing up in commercials. Next thing you know, you're doing this. You're totally self-sufficient. You're not wealth building like they wish you would, but you're having the best time of your life in your 20s in New York City. And that, those type of soft skills you developed during that time that allow you to feel like you could sit at any table really help with business. You know, it really helps me now. You know, who I am as a producer and partner at Hero LA is completely from my time spent in New York City, finding myself and living life, you know, and enjoying life and meeting all sorts of people from different places of the world. So, and the school was not wasted. I look at my math and science background, and to me, you know, and the bartending waiting tables thing I was doing, all of that is all about solutions and problem solving and thinking quickly and being able, even though to me, writing can sometimes be like math. You know, you have A to get to C, what's the joke? And you're just in your mind flipping out scenarios. And to me, that's like math.
It is. You move this part of the puzzle here, and then the whole beginning has to be rejigged because you change the whole thing. And it's a big
puzzle. And then being at a bar with like six deep, and like 80 orders coming at you, people yelling. To me, it's like when things are going crazy on set, I'm just never rattled. Like, it's a problem. Let's fix it. And you do it. And you also learn to have a good time. So like, you know, you learn through those stressful periods when you're young, how to be in the weeds. I'm using air quotes right now, but in the weeds and not just be a total mess. You learn to be in the weeds and still have a great time. And that to me is part of like what producing is like. You don't want to be running around like a chicken with its head cut off. You want to be in control, and you got to know you got to get it done. And at the end of the day, you didn't have to yell at anybody to get anything done. You know what I mean? So
yeah,
it's all connected, dude. It's all connected.
Well, yeah, I think it is connected, but then having the self-awareness to be able to then acknowledge that and sort of use it in a capacity that you're aware of it. But it's interesting because I feel like there is the shift, and it might be a generational one. Talking to other producers I've had on, they kind of talk in a similar sort of way about wanting to work in an environment that's friendly, that's kind, that's embracing, that's empathetic, that helps foster good work. That this idea of being like a dictator or shouting at people or, you know, being regimented might be from a bygone era, because no one wants to be in that kind of environment. Like, nobody's going to get good work out of anybody. And to your point, like, I get it. There is always going to be stress in any job we do, but by the same token, we're making films. We're not doing heart surgery. So there's a different level of stress here
that 100%. We're talking about. You know, and solutions, and there are moments where you feel like someone's purposely trying to anger you, but everyone kind of goes through that. I went through that with my first production, where every email that was coming to my inbox, I felt was like purposely trying to anger me. Looking back, I realized that is not the case. Everyone's just trying to do the best job they can. My job as the producer, and if I want this seat, is to find the solution and move it all forward, and not just the problem, but everyone motivated moving forward and felt like we came to some solution together. And so that idea of like using anger is the easiest, lowest common denominator way to communicate with anybody, even in our political climate, all of that. You know, there's that's to me just checkers, and it, you don't build off of that. Those are all just transactional one-off relationships then. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's super
especially when you're coming up. Yeah, especially when you're coming up and building your connections and relationships, especially with film producing. You want teams that can't wait, that they're going to see the phone, see your name, light up, not only knowing that there might be a job under that call, but then be like, oh man, I can't wait to work with those guys again. You know, and something we're super proud of is after all our productions, when we hang out, people stay, you know, everyone hangs out and we all catch up and it's great. And it's like a family.
You know, when you come together and work on a project, it is like this big moving circus, and then it kind of gets super intense, and then you kind of dissipate when it's done. But those weird kind of familial threads are always there.
Yeah.
And they ain't gonna be there if your short-term mentality approach of just being angry and wanting to get it done allows you to put the blinkers on, because you know, I think we all want a career and a journey, not I don't know what the reason for being angry is for some people, but.
Also, you know, just to clarify, it's also not about being best friends with everyone, because you have a job, and it's like, look, an environment that's safe, protected, where you're clear about what the expectations are. Because when you're working, it's not like, you know, film sets are hard. TV sets are hard. It's hard work. You know, it's not like everyone's running around smiling, but it's an appreciation of being professional and also being relatable. Like, yes, you do get to know people, but at the same time, we have jobs and you have to learn when to be firm with answers. But if you lay out expectations very clearly, it makes everyone's jobs better. And if you're making people's jobs better and easier to do, or very specific about what their jobs are, everyone appreciates that, you know, as opposed to, like, what the F is going on? And why are these people yelling at me? Like, I'm not getting paid enough here to be abused. Like, there are abusive sets and you're hearing them. And you're right. It is part of the sort of zeitgeist right now where, you know, the sort of the Me Too movement is now transferring over to toxic workplace environment. And it's all valid. And I was like, well, we were never there, so we don't even have to worry about that. But I've been there on the other end of that, where I've been on 2 Peter Lenkoff shows. So like, I've been there, but I've never really seen that side, but I've been on, you know, those shows. So
hopefully it's a thing that's being phased out as people realize they just want to have, I think people just want to be respected, dude. Like, you know, I think that I always had this idea of the whole, you know, you got to earn people's respect. I kind of see where it comes from and I do get it, but I like the whole Gary Vee talks about this whole thing of people's respect is sort of, they have his respect implicitly by default at the start, and it's then theirs to lose or keep based on how they engage with them. Because if you don't know somebody, you don't make them try and fight to like impress you. Like, just start on an equal footing and then go from there.
Yeah, it's like relationships. I give everyone trust off the bat. You know, you can lose it with me, but you know, a producer once said something to me that I'll probably carry with me to my grave, which is, as a producer, you earn it every day. You have to earn that every day, and especially if you want to be the lead producer, you earn that. It all works. It's like a meritocracy in some level about who people respect. Like, if you're the one showing up every day and you're the one moving balls forward, and you know, then that respect comes to you. And then eventually those titles come to you, and that's where the relationships are built. But you have to earn it every day. And just like trust, you got to maintain that. Every time you make a decision with someone, you're either fostering more trust or you're diminishing the trust. But that's very much like life to me.
Yeah, exactly. I'm with you there. It's the whole thing of, you know, we talked about sports before you came on and started recording here, but it's the same as any of the top players in a team that lead the team by just their demeanor and the work they put in. Like Kobe was great because Kobe came and trained before anybody and left after everybody, and the mentality was there. Cristiano Ronaldo in football or soccer, same thing. Like yep. There's something about those people, and I don't know if it's a nature or nurture thing. I guess it's a bit of both. There may be exceptions because they are like at a different animalistic level, but I think we can all innately learn from those people in whatever medium, sports or otherwise, and sort of channel that within us because we all have it. It goes back again then to what's your why? Why are you going to put in that effort?
I lean on sports a lot. And it's funny when I first, sorry, there was a lag there. I lean on sports a lot. And I always used to equate acting to sports in a lot of different ways, mentality in terms of mental approach. And now that I'm in business, I lean on my acting experience a lot. But I'm always drawing inspiration from athletes because it's about work ethic. You know, when you talk about Kobe, and I remember being at Sundance and hearing about his death. And I remember finding myself at a bus stop the last night because I was like, I want to take a bus because nothing registers in Sundance. And I needed some time just to sort of like look over the news. I was like, I'm going to take a bus with a transfer back to the condo because I just need my own time to sort of process this whole thing. And I'm not a Laker fan, but I became a huge Kobe fan. And it's all about his mentality and his work ethic. And in some way, I'm always rededicating myself. And I find my inspiration a lot from athletes. I find my work ethic inspiration comes from athletes. My artistic inspiration comes from artists and filmmakers and writers. But my work ethic, I always draw from athletes. And no one's like Kobe. You know, the Mamba mentality is a... it's a real thing, man.
The discipline. I think that's the beautiful thing, though, that we can sort of, in this day and age, with this whole crazy internet thing, look at different sources of inspiration and find things that resonate with who you are and sort of make your own amalgamation of those that work for you and apply that to your own innate personality and find something that just fits, whether it's, like you're saying, taking a bit from Kobe and then looking at artists and fusing it to bring together that combo of a businessman who has his own business and production company, but that works in a very creative capacity. And how can you fuse those two worlds together? And I mean, what I wanted to touch on a few moments ago was the idea of relatability, which you spoke about a couple of minutes back. How much do you feel the fact that you have the acting background, that you write as well, that you, you know, have done directing, helps you as a producer to be able to relate and empathize with other people that you collaborate with now?
I mean, it's really the essence of what I think makes me the producer that I am is my acting background. You know, I think actors are unique because they touch on every department. They don't get to see the behind the curtains of the production and the financing, but they know the principal keys on a film or a TV series. They relate to writers tremendously. And if you're, I think all actors should write. You learn a lot. You know, the more I wrote, the more I understood the sides to my auditions. Like, what's the intention of the writer? And then the more you understand the overall process, you're like, what's my role in this scene? Mm-hmm. Not only from a writing perspective, but from a cinematography perspective. Like, you know, and then being able to relate to actors is huge because, you know, especially the bigger the names get, you know what I mean? The more important it is to be like, you know, I had to take our film to Rome and I was traveling with Mira Sorvino and Gil Bellows and Jay, you know, well, Gil Bellows, Melora Walters and Mira and Chris Backus, Mira's husband. And there was a great, like, you're the producer, you're running it, but then you're also able to sit down. And when I'm with actors, I feel like I'm just with actors. And so I'm comfortable there. I'm very comfortable, like, just hanging out. And I think it gives them comfort. But then you have to do your job. And you can also do the producer side which is a lot of the times a logistics. Sure. You know what I mean? But just being able to empathize with actors is important. Crew members, you kind of know, you know, the camera department, you know, the art department, all of them, you kind of know their personalities a little bit. And so it helps you, you have a common ground. It was the other side that was all new, you know, that I didn't have as an actor, which is sort of the pre-production and the financing and the sure. whole sort of behind the curtain of the studios. You're just not really, you know, because they all treat the actors like kid gloves, and I see it now. And you think they're all your friends, but they're really just trying to keep the actor in a space where they feel safe. And by for actors, it's really like, just don't mess with them, because if they go into their heads, you don't want that. You want them to feel as free. Like, we gave you the job. We want you to feel as free as you can to do the job. But, you know, having that understanding, that big picture, I think really helps me. It's the business side of it that where all the growth has had to happen over the last 4 years. But that's just as fascinating. So the other side feels like that's cheat code for me.
Sure.
I'm comfortable with all those elements.
It's interesting about the whole business side of it, though, because obviously it's show business. And that's a big side that I think actors sometimes either don't want to know about or struggle with. Less so maybe in the States. Over in Europe, it's still sort of one that people definitely don't get taught much at all, or not as much as they maybe should be, which I always find intriguing, because my mantra is always kind of like, well, look at what some of the top actors in the world are doing. And to me, it's no surprise that many of them, beyond diversifying outside of acting, also within the game, many of them have their own production companies, or at least exec produce on a lot of projects. And there's a reason for that. I guess, you know, what's your take? You said about saying actors should all write. Do you feel that now with the era that we're in, most, if not many, actors should really look at making their own content as well, because of just the liberty it gives them as an artist?
100%. I mean, it's been so democratized now. Like, you know, I'm not fully on the band of like TikTok and yeah, there's YouTube and there's Instagram, and those are all great mediums. But more important, you should be creating in any shape or form. I remember in New York, it's like you start a theater company, you know.
Sure.
It's, yes, we are, you're your own product and you're trying to get hired. But I remember saying to myself, like, you can't act 10 hours a day. You just can't do it. You know, you have hours on top of hours to learn more about the industry. And the more you learn, the better chance you have of reaching your goals. You know, and writing was one of them. And then writing eventually leads to let's make something. Then making something will eventually lead to, well, how do we distribute it? And then how do you sell it? If you're curious about it, the industry and the entertainment is so much more than just who you are as an actor. There are some actors that are just, that I'm sure could just act and be totally fine. But I just feel like it just leads to infinite curiosity. You know, mm-hmm. It's the same with theater. You know, hey, let's get together and read some scenes, right? That should go to, let's get two more actors. Hey, let's read a play. Hey, we've been reading, and this happens, you know, we've been reading a play every week. Why don't we put one up? You know, and then you put one up and get a theater. Like, that's just sort of how it goes. And it shouldn't be any more different on the film side. It's just a few more technical hurdles.
Sure.
But things couldn't be easier now than ever. Editing, the cameras are cheaper, all of it is right there for you.
And I mean, you've kind of proved it with quarantine, with the fact that, you know,
yeah.
That is a prime example of, let's just do a few episodes, let's just improv it, we've got a loose idea, let's keep going because people are watching. Oh crap, yeah. We've done 60 of these, how did that happen?
Yeah, quarantine was that spirit meeting professionals. And so it was like real show running. There was a real writer's room. We had legal, we had marketing, we had PR. Like, we were building all of that at the top, and the train was moving as we were building it. And we were learning like a new medium. So that is what could happen if you have professionals doing it.
Sure.
Now, that should also be what can happen if you just do it and figure it out. Like, it's going to be a little messier. Like, we understand some certain standard practices and communication and all this stuff. And what being professionals allows us to bring in professional actors. You know, most of our actors were on series because they were down.
Sure.
You know, and then all our guest stars were names. And, you know, going to their managers and agents, that fosters that level of confidence in your production. But you could do the same exact thing with just your friends. And then everyone's just game. You know, there's two ways to approach things. And I just had this conversation in terms of a film we're getting involved in. And there's a DIY way to do it, which is like you kickstart, everyone's a producer, all hands on deck and let's make it. And then there's the way to do it where it's still low budget, but you're coming from the top down. It's like, look, we can't just hand out producer credits. There's so many levels where that matters, where you're financing. Okay, that's who are these guys? And then the next level would be bringing on real producers. It'd be like, who are these other producers? Then the next level is a chain of title and sale. Like, there's two ways to approach the same project, and they're both valid. You just kind of got to know what the smart play is for you and what you're going for.
And where you're at, I guess, in your journey. I think it's interesting. And I think everybody, you know, like it was the same for me. You start out doing your own stuff, just like you were saying, smaller scale, get filmmaker friends, come together. You just kind of put in some cash between all you. You do your thing. You may self-fund one or two projects, but after a while, you can't put in thousands of dollars every time unless you're one of the Duplass brothers and you can kind of do that. And then it gets to the next level and it's like, okay, well, I've done a few. Now what's the next step up? Okay, well, the next step up is I got to raise funding. How do I do that? Is it crowdfunding? Is it private finance? Yep. Is it, you know, there's government bodies or there's different grants? Is it actually getting a producer who's more established like yourself or someone else who can help with that process? And then you start to sort of escalate up to, you know, another level. And I guess next thing you know, 4 or 5 years have passed. You look back and you've, you know, had a company that's now, you've done the feature film that's gone to festivals. You've done Quarantine. You do a lot of branded content too, right?
Yeah, we do branded content. We've done pilots. We work with Condé Nast and done some elevated docs there. And now we have several feature films on the table and one in pre-production. It's you can only do it by going through the steps. And with each step, you garner more experience and the more people are willing to work with you. It's, and the world gets smaller though. It gets a little easier, but also gets a little harder.
Okay. Interesting. In what way? Elaborate on that. Harder in the sense of?
It gets harder because the ambitions get bigger and you have a lot more speculation. Like, you know, this feature, TV and film are both speculative businesses. You know, you have an idea, it could take years or it can happen quickly. Branded is where like you have a quicker turnaround and there's cash, you can keep the company going. And they're all awesome endeavors. They're all different, but you have to understand like TV and film could be home runs, but we also do short films and we have seven commercial directors rostered, artists I believe in, and we've shot a couple shorts for them with Hero behind them, ensuring and bringing our production to it, or our gear or whatever it is. But it's easier because everyone's better at their jobs. You're more efficient, but it's harder because it's a crowded field.
Sure.
It's a very crowded field and you have to have a lot of resiliency and you have to just keep plodding along. You know what I mean? Nothing gets handed to you, put it that way. Nothing gets handed to you in this industry. You have to really go get it and keep proving yourself along the way and keeping yourself busy. So that's why we feel fortunate because we have our film, TV, and our branded side. We're always busy in one shape or form. We're not always making money doing what we're doing, but we're always busy.
It is that long game though, right? Because it's not, I mean, it is about making money because obviously it's a business that's got to hit a profit and you're living off of it. But it's easy to fall into the trap of just making stuff that's going to make money too.
100%. Like from the very beginning, we were determined to set up it as a business properly. There's so many different ways and we've seen different businesses and we've come in contact with different businesses. My interest has always been in people who have built companies, you know, like a Radical Media, you know, and I would take meetings with people that I knew and be like, my questions were all, how did you go from you two to a company of 200? You know, and then there's a lot of production companies where it's just the person. You know, there's a sandwich media where the guy's at the top and all his connections, it all runs through him, but you can't scale properly. So we're looking to not only keep scaling, but we're also looking to say, have assets, equity, and then go for an investment, you know, and then have build a business from there, and then eventually have a valuation where we can be something in this town, you know what I mean? And not just a team that can make things, but
it starts with that. It starts with that.
You have to have the vision at the beginning on some level. Otherwise, the scaling becomes difficult. That's even in your partnership agreements. That's where the business at the beginning is all super important, so that you're all on the same page. It's no different than a film. If the chain of title is not clear at the top, you're going to run into problems. So we were very mindful in the beginning of the ambition of what we want to do, but just focusing on each next step. So each step was always under the umbrella of, does this fit into our overall goals and our plans? And can we scale? Like, what is our vertical from this position? As opposed to just doing things to do things. We always have to understand our company's why. Why are we partnering here? Why are we taking on this project? And if it doesn't get us to our overall goal, actors would understand that as like a character is super objective. It defines every decision you make. And if you know it, then each answer is very simple. Yes, no. If it's a lateral move, what's the vertical from there? Does it get me closer to my goal? And that's just very useful to have. And that's part of your why, but also like a real target goal.
And I guess you're revising that, obviously, not every day, but obviously like every year you kind of just check in, I guess, and look at where you are in that progress and do a bit of an inventory on what decisions
move you forward. The goal is the same.
Sure.
The goal is the same. We'll evaluate where we spend our time and how we spend our time and how it's a lot of communication. We spend a lot of time talking about communication and definition and a lot of time on philosophy, our company philosophy. We often get into just these questions of like, how we see this being set up. What's our values? Why did this happen? Is it because of our company value isn't clear here? Like, it sounds corporate, but it's not. It's just three people drinking scotch, having conversations of like, why did that suck? Why did that experience suck? Why was that breakdown there? And then we'll talk and talk. And it always has to go down to the value. Like, what do we believe in? You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, it's from having worked in corporate. It's corporate when somebody hands you like a little pamphlet with three words on them and they put them on the wall of the office and they just kind of regurgitate them. And they're like, these are our values. Yeah, cool. But what do they mean? Like, and also the word growth isn't a value, guys. Like, why do you use the word growth all the time with everything? Like,
oh my God, shoot me.
What does that mean? What does growth mean? In what way? Growth, is it, do you mean more money? Grow as a person? Like, what? We all want growth. That's not a value. It's not even a reason. But that's my bugbear from working in digital marketing agencies for over a decade, always kind of being in that thing of, it's patronizing because nobody believes what you're saying because you don't believe it because it's not even your words. And I always found it super interesting.
You know, it's funny, like a lot of our values come from things that come up all the time. When we talk about things in a certain way all the time, we realize that's a value of ours. But I can see the difficulty and of scaling to a point where you have so many employees where you're not all talking all the time. Then these are our company values. I think inevitably every great artistic endeavor or great creative endeavor gets muddied by business and scale.
It's the compromise. It's where the compromise comes in. It's like, well, we'll make this, but to make it, you need us to do this. And for that to happen, you got to give up something over here. And it's how far are you willing to go? At what point will you pick up your bags and go to Africa in the Dave Chappelle world?
Exactly.
Which, you know, for me is the most amazing example of values of someone. Granted, he had no need for money in his life anymore after that, but it still would have been easy for him to keep doing that show. And it must have been a tough fucking call to be like, nah, I'm out.
I think, you know, what he probably did was realize this is not sustainable and it's going to hurt me. And so it becomes to me a survival situation. That's how I took it. Like, he was like, if I don't leave, something bad's going to happen.
Mm.
You know, and I think that leads to just sort of mental health in this industry. You know, you have to, especially during this pandemic we're in, and I'm genuinely, or generally speaking, a pretty positive and strong person. And I find myself with a couple down days, but, and I'll be like, whoa, someone please rear-end me today, because I would love to get out of my car and just have at it and release, you know what I mean? But you have to constantly check in with yourself, not just individually, but with your company. You know, are we all happy? Are we still moving in the same direction together?
And I guess, yeah. You know, we pre-lockdown, we came from an environment in most, at least Western countries, that was a zillion miles an hour, go, 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 like sleep is the enemy, like, you know, efficiency, all this stuff, which I guess in one way kind of made sense, but actually this has given us a good reflection point to go, was that healthy, and can we actually do really good work by being balanced, actually sleeping enough, and just being effective, but quality over quantity still always wins. And mm-hmm. You know, you spoke about mental health and stuff there, and I think that's a big, that's gonna, for me with this whole situation, that's gonna be the long legacy point, along with the economy impact of this lockdown, that you're kind of seeing the bubbles of it a little bit now, but I think a lot of people mental health wise have been challenged big time by this whole thing. And there has to be, whatever we go back into, from my take, a much more balanced approach to work and life, because it's just too short, man. Too short. Like, if another lockdown comes, then what?
Look, the door has been opened. We've all glimpsed what it's like to work at our own tempo. Not that we all want to work from home forever, but I now know that we don't have to get together for everything, because it's always like in LA, drive, park, land, say what's up to everybody, settle down, okay, let's work. Then all of a sudden it's like, I gotta leave, I gotta pick up the daughter from soccer. Now it's like, yeah, I'm working longer hours, but it's at my own tempo. But then there's also no cap to how often and how much you're working. And so
sure,
I've developed that. Now I kind of do shut off on the weekends. I'm not working on the weekends unless I absolutely have to. But I am working to like midnight on some nights. You know what I mean? But
sometimes that was happening anyway, dude. Let's be real. Yeah. So
that's what I'm saying. It's, and I was there. It was just the fact you could do it at your own tempo and get all your stuff done at home. There's something really special about that. And I know things are going to change. I know we've changed. Like, I don't need to go to downtown LA anymore. Like, we just pre-prod an entire TV series from home. So that's already carrying over to the future. You know, we don't have to meet in person. It is great to meet in person. Like it's a hybrid. It's going to be a hybrid.
It's a hybrid, but I think that's perfect, because before it was way too far on the other end of the scale, where it just became like almost an obligation from somewhere. Like, why do we have to, I don't know, run ourselves into the ground for what? You know, you don't want to look back at 70 and then be like, where did my time go? Like, why did I miss that soccer practice or that time with the family or whatever? And it's easy to get lost in that. But at the end of the day, I don't think anyone's going to have our obituary read that we were punctual to every meeting. I hope not anyway.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't do well in that game.
Exactly. You spoke about, obviously, I mean, moving up from quarantine and you're kind of looking at other projects and you're working on stuff now. How is it sort of looking over in LA? I know in the UK here, some bigger projects have started filming or they're kind of getting into gear. These are like big TV shows that were already having done one or two seasons. I think they had insurance already that have probably allowed them to cover and start up. I'm not sure what it's like there. Do you know if anything's actually filming yet or what?
Yeah. There's work going on and TV shows are back and there's been features that have been shot. There's definitely COVID protocols. We've shot a couple things. We're gearing up to shoot a feature between Thanksgiving and Christmas, but it's all the other sort of elements that are, you have to consider. Like, you have to get through the unions. You have to present a proper protocol, but the proper protocols add about 20 to 30% on your budgets. So there's all sorts of hurdles or reasons to prohibit you from shooting. you know, so a lot of people are leaving LA to shoot just because if you do the math, maybe you're saving some money. But things are gearing up. I mean, the commercial side's really picking up. There's jobs coming through there. TV's picking up. I have friends' shows that are going back. And another friend just finished a feature in downtown LA. You know, I just asked him recently, like, what his COVID breakdown ended up being. And he was like 15% of the budget. And so to me, I was like, that's one of the better ones I've heard, you know. But if you think about it, that's a lot.
That's a lot of money, man.
That's a lot of money. And especially if you're not working on the studio level or the network level where you're trying to make, you know, our features are trying to make under 500,000, these next two. So yeah, that eats up in big chunks.
What's your take on that then? Because it sounds like my gut for an indie feature world feels like it's doable, but it's always a stretch anyway with an indie feature with your time.
Yeah.
And obviously this is tagging on extra time, which means extra money. Do you feel like the idea of the profit margin might be eaten in? Do you think it's wait for indies a while longer until the protocols mellow down?
Well, it's definitely part of the conversation we're having. It could be cost prohibitive. We're having a meeting on Friday. You know, we have our budget and we realize what's happening to it. And it could be, you know, there's hope that maybe post January, things calm down and you don't need the 20 to 30%, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And so there's that conversation. There's no real conversation where you don't want to look out for the safety of the cast and crew.
Sure.
But does it have to be 20, 30%? Because that doesn't feel sustainable. I don't think we can make the features we want to make at 20 to 30%. But there's lab testing. That's another thing, is that we're just so far behind on not just the amount of COVID there is in LA and how many people have it, but we're behind on labs and tests and sort of how available it is. Like, we're not at a point yet where, you know, you could just, they require tests 3 times a week, you know what I mean? And that's a lot depending on the size of your crew. That's a lot of money, but the labs are backed up. So the whole workflow is not 100% smoothed out, and it's just exacerbated by the situation. So, I mean, we all get a vaccine and then we're out of it come 2022. What year is this? What year are we in? 2020?
What are years?
I don't know if you're having this issue. I can't even remember yesterday anymore. I'm like so focused on today and the next 2 days. And I think I've been conditioned to just not look too far ahead because the world changes on a dime and everything behind us feels inconsequential. Like, we made it to today.
Yeah, there's the bit of like thinking back to a few months ago, and that seems like a decade ago because the reference of time is non-existent for a start.
Yeah.
There's almost more for me the notion of just continually catching myself going, what day is it? Does it matter? I don't know. Like, is it Friday, Thursday, Wednesday? What have I got to do today? Like, what's my appointments? Oh, no, I don't have any. And that's the weird thing. Less so for me because I've always worked from home for the past few years, but for friends I know that were always working in the sort of outside world and then came to this, and now they've slowly gone back out to work in the outside world a little bit more over here, they found that shift really weird because it's almost like you gave up your old life for 3 months, 4 months, then you start to go back to this slightly similar version of your old life, but it's not really. And that was a big head fuck for them because it's almost like, I don't know how I feel about this. Like, I'm glad to be out, but there's this concept of time is back, but not fully.
Yeah.
And then there was like, for one of my friends, this knock on where he was sort of going out for a few days and meeting people. But then when he would go back home and be inside for 3-4 days straight, he had like weird withdrawal symptoms.
Wow.
Because it's such extremes of like
one. Dude, we are in strange times. Like, that concept of just not understanding time before and time out. This is getting a little crazy. The next is like, but I'm hearing you talk about it and I'm like, many people are experiencing this. The sheer fact they'd be like, what day is today? Like, you don't know what day it is. Like, I don't know if I'm close to the weekend or not. Like, it could be Monday today or it could be Friday. But I think it's Thursday.
Yeah.
Yeah, I knew that.
But it feels like a Wednesday. Who knows? It's one of those where, like, does it matter?
Well, that's why I think my brain's been conditioned. I'm not even thinking behind me. I'm just thinking today and slightly in front of me while being able to plan on a calendar. And so I'm in this pocket of, this is my target. And in a lot of ways, I think my brain works like that. You know, I have a certain amount of RAM and I'm about projects. I'm on it and then I'm off of it and I shift, you know? And I think that explains why I learn things all the time and then I completely forget them. Like, I'll learn to play an entire song on YouTube on my guitar.
Yeah.
And it'd be great. And then 3 weeks later, I can't remember the chord progression. Like, it's just there, I'm focused on it, and then it's gone.
That's perfect then to be in film, especially as a producer. It's just intense project based, all in. And then when it's done, it's like, erase that bit of the RAM and free up space for the next one.
Like, yeah.
Makes sense.
That, well, that's how I've been looking at it. I feel like, and I've explained it to my partners, I was like, guys, I think I'm starting to understand myself a little better. I'm a very project oriented person and I'm on it to the end. You know, there's obviously all the business development and planning and relationships. And that's just emails to me. Like, emails and meetings is an aspect. Those are friendships and relationships. And but when it comes to the work, it's like I get hyper focused and then I'm off. And then I literally can't remember a thing about it.
So how do you find that in terms of then when you have multiple projects? Do you try and limit how many you're doing at any one time? Obviously, there's going to be different levels and stages there at naturally.
But... It's funny you say that because I went through a stretch where I was executive producing. I executive produced 3 shorts at a time along with our branded side. And it was great because the first round of it was incredible because you bring your experience to the table. This is what we're doing. You have the meetings. And I mistakenly thought that, okay, great, we'll move on. I'll see you guys in the next round. And the next round, I'm having meetings with the teams and I'm constantly asking questions. They're like, oh, we already went over that in the emails. Oh, so everything out of my mouth, I was sounding stupid because I wasn't up to where everything was. I was like, all right, executive producing does not mean you can totally let go of the projects. You have to be on top of what's happening all the time. And so I made that adjustment, but it was that one gap where I was like, well, this is easy. You just have to show up for meetings and meet and have conversations, but you do have to stay on top of it. So while we talk about all the time, it's like, I can't be the lead producer on too many things at one time. And I have to have my right-hand guy if it's going to be something that I need to be off of. Like right now we have the feature going and this TV project that we have going. And then on the branded side, we were meeting that exact question came up today about like, what is your level of ability to commit to each one of these? And so I just have to define it. And if it's defined and the expectations are set from the other people's side, we're good. If we just leave it out there, then it's a mess.
Yeah, it's always a recipe for disaster. That's the key thing. Yeah. It's expectation management and just being able to actually be real with people and say,
you have to be honest.
Yeah.
About your capabilities, your time, and right up front, let people know this is what I can do for this, and this is what you can expect from me. And that's kind of what I learned from that little stretch of films was, you can't just say you're an executive producer and think that, okay, that means I barely have to produce because there's a producer. But if you're going to add value to the project, you have to kind of understand what's happening. And so now when I EP something, I define that, you know, and EPing in commercials is different than executive producing a film. But as long as everyone knows what their expectations are and what they can expect of you, you're good.
The add value part is the key part. And I guess the interesting part, just to hear you talk about it, because it clearly shows that, you know, your ethos or your values, if we're going back to that, is about not just doing it because, but like, how can you bring your experience and what you have to offer to the project to enhance it? And I assume that obviously if you feel like you can't, or you feel like someone else can, it might be tough, but maybe that's a pass and that has to be okay.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's you're asking yourself with every project that's presented in front of you, you know, but that takes experience. And I'm not even going to lie here. You know, I'm always over my skis a little bit, meaning like the company has been over its skis, but that's how we've grown. And I've learned that that's where we like to live. I like the challenge, you know, like even with quarantine, we shot that on Zoom and I vocalized, you know, we're out pitching the show. I'm not interested in shooting another show on Zoom. I just did that. and there's no real challenge there to go back and do it again. Mm-hmm. I want to see the next generation of it, the next iteration, which to me would be a hybrid, you know, small crew single camera with the zoom. But that's very much part of our DNA. It's not a value of ours, but it's very much part of my DNA and the company's DNA, is where we're always doing something we're slightly over our skis. So we're always taking bigger projects, bigger scope, bigger scale, more complicated. We're always trying to challenge ourselves in one way or another. But we wonder, is that a bad thing? Why not sit down, lock in, and become an expert at one aspect of that production? But that doesn't seem to interest us. So we just keep going forward and like, yeah.
I mean, does it have to be that way? I mean, I get the idea of going niche and going deep. And I think from a purebred like business perspective, it does make sense. But again, yeah, you go back to that point of what do you enjoy doing and what makes you happy? And
I think that's part of not coming from the business side. I think that's part of coming from the creative side, is that curiosity is incredibly important. You know, I'm just curious all the time, you know, and to be enthusiastic and curious, you want to be challenged. You want to be doing new things. You want to be working with new people, but at the same time, you can't overextend yourself. You know, you have to be very honest about what you're capable of and not get in way too over your head. We seem to be good at that. We seem to be good at just taking the next step, but we keep taking steps. You know, every 6 months we look back at our company, we're like, we can't believe we were there 6 months ago. It seems to have been a pattern. Like, we'd be like, can you believe that was 6 months ago? Like, that feels like eons ago. And so now we're doing other stuff. But the profile keeps raising, and the people we're working with, the profile keeps raising. And I don't know if it's sustainable. I mean, this is all new. It's all new. Every day is new. And we'll see, you know.
I guess it's part of the journey though, right? Like, you have to ask those questions, but also it's okay that you don't have the answers to that, because.
Yeah. I guess the not knowing and the risk is part of the excitement. Like, I guess you don't become an actor if you want a safe life. Yeah, life's gonna be, I'm gonna be an actor.
But you know what, now though, it's actually for the first time with all this that's been going on, you can kind of sit back and go, well, now everybody else kind of knows what's up. Like, not everybody's that secure now anyway. Not in a good way, but it is like the job for life didn't really exist for a long time anyhow. But I think a lot of people now are really waking up and going, maybe I have to diversify, because that like one job for 10 years or whatever,
yeah,
that's not gonna fly. And like, tech's evolving. Have you do you know Yuval Noah Harari? Have you heard of that guy? The guy that wrote the book Sapiens. Have you heard of that book?
Oh yes, I've heard of that book. I think I've read excerpts from it.
Like, he did three of them, and his last one was more about like projecting into the 21st century going forward, what potential things might happen. And one thing that he speculates is, with the advancement of AI and technology, the big challenge isn't going to be like the skills that we have lasting us for a lifetime, because they won't, because there's going to be such new changes so frequently that our biggest challenge is going to be learning soft skills that let us change and adapt to learn new things more often. Because you might have an era where like every 5 to 10 years, the skill set that you once learned now is a null and void, and you have to learn a brand new skill set that didn't even exist 5, 10 years ago. And that, to me, is such an interesting...
That's fascinating.
...daunting and scary prospect, but actually really, like, you can sort of see little bits of it almost slowly happening already, like driverless cars come in, or Uber, like, coming into play. You see the impact on people that were cab drivers. Like, what's the next iteration of that? And how does that right. play out for everybody else? Like, imagine you have to reskill every 5 years. How do we deal with that as a human that doesn't like...
I feel like I reskill every month.
Okay, you'll be good. You'll be fine. That's what I mean, though, as artists and creatives, you kind of have to inherently do that and be okay with having to learn new shit. It's interesting.
Well, it doesn't make for a dull life, that's for sure.
Exactly, exactly. Cool, dude. Well, look, I like to sort of round these off and wrap them up with the good old actor studio questions that James Lipton used to ask people.
Oh yeah, the exact same ones. I don't remember them.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, as an homage.
Do you remember the French guy? Wasn't it a French guy?
That yeah, what was it? Pivot or something.
Gérard Pivot, is that it? Or someone?
Something Pivot. Right. I don't know the first name, but I was like, well, if James Lipton stole them, then I'm just going to steal them from him, because that's what all artists do, right? We take from other people. Sure. So yeah, let's do a quick fire on that to wrap it up. Just whatever comes to mind. First question is, what is your favorite word?
I mean, I hate to say it, but it's basically fuck.
Oh man, but that's the fifth question.
Fuck what's me. Your, fuck what, this.
Okay, well
fuck
that's
that. That's I'm a New Yorker
your,
too.
That's what's your favorite swear word? So we'll,
oh,
we'll amalgamate the two. But if you want to give a non-curse word, you can do that.
My favorite non-curse word. Oh God. Oof. I like the word, and I'm not always, it's weird because I'm not always sure what it means, but it's, and I can't even remember right now, but I love it every time I hear it. It's a German word, and I think it's not Blitzkrieg, but it's a word like that it's very zeitgeisty right now. Hold on a second.
Dude, I'm in the UK. You can't say Blitzkrieg over to people.
No, I'm sorry. Sorry.
I don't care, but people here get nervous.
Oh God, they say the administration does it a lot right now. This must be some favorite word, but I can't remember it, but I love it every single time I hear it.
Okay.
You can edit this, so I know. You can cut all this time out.
No, I'm leaving it in. It's great. It makes for it makes for tension.
Oh, it's similar, I think, to gaslighting, but I think it's a German term for it.
Oh man, I don't know. It's going to be one of those where we won't figure it out, and then we'll you'll just remember randomly later and email me. No, it's not coming.
No.
Well, let's keep going, because it might come to you later, and you'll be like, "I remember what it was."
I'm stuck on it right now. And I'm bummed I can't pull it to the top. My brain cannot go past yesterday. It just doesn't go past yesterday.
Well, let's try and short circuit and bypass your brain.
Okay, let me bypass this one. Maybe I'll come back.
And maybe it'll just come back to you now that it's in the subconscious. What's your least favorite word? Oh,
no.
Okay. What turns you on in a creative, spiritual, intellectual kind of way?
Not just in a word, right? Like what turns me on?
That's like a one word answer.
Just conversation without agenda, without judgment. You know, ideally with like some whiskey sitting in the backyard, just being able to have long conversations with one person, and you can really dig into something where you know that it's not about trying to be right. Or someone trying to be right or wrong, just going with ideas and sort of like one-upping each other till you land somewhere and you're like, oh shit.
It's like a dance.
Oh, I never thought of that.
Yeah. The best thing about the whiskey is it can dilute the judgment and it can show the agenda pretty quick if it's there.
It can't be too late in that night. You can't be on like two, like three, four, five. This has got to be sort of early when you're sort of just relaxed.
I hear you. What the flip to that is, what turns you off?
Defensiveness.
Okay.
People who have to prove that they're right or need to be right. Like there's no such thing as right to me. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in ideas. I'm interested in conflict. I like conflict where you can have those conversations, but it's not about like I'm right and you're wrong, but I enjoy and I'll lean into arguments as long as they're not malintended or malicious or someone feels like they have to win. I like getting into it with people on things.
Yeah, as people can kind of check the ego a little bit and sort of sense when it's flaring up and put it to one side, then there is a healthy aspect to that, but it's uncomfortable too, you know, and I think it's not easy. Like sometimes some people, I can say myself included, you have to kind of learn to be kind of comfortable in that situation.
You do. You do. But it's like, you know, you go back to your young days. There's nothing better than like getting into a fight with someone and then going to get a drink together afterwards, like a stranger. Yeah, yeah. Like it's just that same thing. You can let it go and know it's not personal.
That for me is the beauty of martial arts and things like the UFC, for example, because not all of them, but you can watch it and see that these guys go in there, and to an outsider, it seems like a blood sport. And I suppose I get why, but actually there's a science and a dance to the way that they do this and the discipline these athletes have. But then a lot of them, after they beat the crap out of each other, they're praising each other, and there's a respect, and there's this kind of camaraderie with many of them. And I do think that there's something about that that has a lot of lessons to it for people. It's you know, Bruce Lee did the Tao of Jeet Kune Do, his book, and it's not really about fighting styles. I mean, it is, but the first half is philosophy. It's got nothing to do with, you know, how to guard your center line or how to like position your footwork. It's mindset. And yeah, I find that a fascinating kind of thing for people to study, because I think it does fuse into life if you see beyond the punching and kicking part of it.
So much to be learned from that guy, by the way.
Absolutely. We'll save that for another time. Next question you already answered, which is, what's your favorite swear word? But, you know, as a New Yorker, I'm going to let you say it again, because I'm sure it's just in your DNA.
I mean, fuck that. Fuck you.
All right.
It's just such a easy one. Yeah. I'm bummed. I cannot believe I can't think of this German word. I'm going to email you later on it.
Do it. Email me. Email me later.
Come back to me.
I'll edit it in. I'll do like a little VO thing to edit it in or something. Send me a voice recording, just a voice snippet, and I'll
you can edit it and be like, the word he was thinking of was so.
Exactly.
So.
Exactly. We'll do that. Next question is, what sound or noise do you love?
Laughter. Cackling, laughter, anything that makes me smile. I don't have to know them. I don't have to see them. If I hear it and I hear laughter and cackling laughter, I'm drawn to it, and it'll make me laugh. And I'm all about that.
What sound or noise turns you off? Do you not like at all?
This is going to sound terrible, but crying babies now. I have a 15-year-old, and I went through that. But now it seems like I've gone to a place where I almost have a single person's mentality. Like,
right?
Why be around crying babies? I used to have so much sympathy and empathy for it, and now I hear crying babies and I just go the total other way. They're cute and I love them, and I love all my friends' kids, but crying babies, like, no.
It's like, being there, done that, I don't need to revisit it again.
I'll endure it on an airplane, and I won't get any, but I'm saying, if I have a choice to move away from it and not be around it, I just have no interest in general around little kids anymore.
Fair enough. I guess it's like, you know, you do the Universal Studios tour once, you don't really go back again, because...
Oh, God, dude. It's the same. Please, no. I'm ready for the kids to join us and have wine with us. I'm at that stage. I'm ready for my daughter to, like, hustle up.
There you go.
Be able to join us at the adult table and enjoy our lives. So.
Well, you know, man, you gotta get them out to Venice more often with you and make more movies so you can go and have the culture over there where they all drink from the age of six. Like, you know, it's...
I know.
It's widely accepted.
So many reasons to move to Europe. So many. And an Italian producer offered me a work visa for a year. So it's very possible.
It's one of those where it's sort of like, ride the rest of this year out and just see what life even looks like. It's like you said, one step at a time with all this.
Yeah, it's all on the table. It's all on the table.
As it should be, dude. That's what life's about. Final few questions. So the last few, next one is, what job or profession other than the ones that you've done to date would you most like to attempt?
Well, if you can call this a job or a profession, but I will forever always stick by this. The only thing I would love to do more than I do is be a rock star.
Nice.
A musician, preferably a singer songwriter, someone that can, like, I'm a hack with my guitar. I'm a hack with my voice, but, you know, I was watching a video of the Rolling Stones backstage, and I'm just the energy, it's everything acting is, performing, it's live, it's never the same. And I don't think you can replicate that. I know sports is probably close, but, you know, come on, man. Music, singing, playing rock and roll, that's got to be the jam.
And, yeah, like you said, kind of like when you're doing theater, that you're taking that song, but you're sort of making it different every time. And the great musicians always, when you watch them live, it's like watching it for the first time because it's a different take every time. And
yeah,
they'll just bring something out that you've never heard before. And it's like, wow, that's a different take on the same thing. That's nuts.
Exactly. But, you know, to be fair, it's not something I could do. So
that's not the point.
Something that I guess that's not the point. Oh, great. Good.
No. Yeah, if you could, you know, Robin Williams as the genie reappears and he gives you a wish, there you go. What job or profession would you never want to attempt?
Anything with a ton of spreadsheets.
Okay.
Accounting, spreadsheets. Like I've only adopted spreadsheets in the last year or two, and I enjoy having them. But if my entire job was staring at spreadsheets, no,
it's mind-numbing. That's one of those things where hopefully AI will actually come in and take some of that stuff away from people. Although there's probably some people that really love it, so maybe they shouldn't. I don't know. Not for me either. It's a little. It feels a bit soul-destroying.
That does. So that and for sure the guy that scoops up elephant shit behind the elephant at the circus. Those two guys.
Yes, I guess. I've not ever had that answer before, but. If I ever do like a sort of show reel answer to all these questions, that's starting the reel off because that's
got to be the worst job on the planet.
That is a pretty bad job. I mean,
visually, olfactory, like your smell, everything about it is.
Yeah, like who the fuck did you piss off to get that job? It's one of those ones, right? Like even the clowns come out better than you. That's not a good sign. Final question is, when it's all said and done, what would you like the story of your life to be? What kind of legacy would you like to leave behind?
Wow, that's a big question.
I know.
I've always said this, I'm not a religious person, but I believe there's something. But I always said that, at the end of the day, you know, and I'm a fatalist, whenever it's over, it's going to have been a good run. But your legacy is really what you left behind in terms of the people in your life. They're the ones that are going to judge you. So instead of being judged by God, I always think about the real judgment's going to come from the people you left on earth. Was he a good dude? You know, was he honest? Did he work hard? Did he love his family? All those things. I think I just want to be known as someone who tried every day to be better than he was the day before, till the day I die. And I believe in that. I believe in learning till the day I die. I believe youth is in enthusiasm and curiosity, and I hope to have that till the day I die. But it's all those things of just trying to be better, because it's a journey, you know. Like even when you're younger, you work on things, and I had a lot to work on. You know, I had no empathy. I used to be a person with zero empathy, and just to be able to keep working on that and work on sort of being your character, the quality of your character at all times. That's it. I don't know where you'll end up, and it's not about praise at the end of your life, but I think it's just about being better today than you were yesterday. And if you do that, you'll grow. Who knows how far you grow, but I think that's all that matters, man.
Yeah, forward momentum, and each day is like a blank canvas. If you can manage to wash away the past one and sort of paint a new picture with it, that's sort of what you're aiming for. And I think that inspires people indirectly if you manage to do that anyway. Like just focus on your own journey, your own growth, and everything else kind of falls where it may. No, I hear you. I guess last couple of minutes to you, really, dude. Like, any final parting thoughts you want to leave people with, and, you know, any stuff you want to plug, where people can maybe catch you on the socials or connect with Hero? Just the floor is yours.
Sure. I mean, I'm not a huge social media person. You know, I have presences, but it's like, you know, it's on Instagram, it's at True Ying. Facebook, I use a lot of that for sort of, my social media is mostly for marketing on some level, just to keep people abreast.
Same.
Of Same. What's happening. Because I have a great network, and without finding that fine line of what's too much and what's not enough is important. And I think it was also important as an artist to transition from an artist to a more of a, to have a company and a business. They have to see the effort, the consistency, the real dedication towards trying to create something. You can't just be like, hey, out of nowhere, hey, I've got a business, I'm doing this. It's, you kind of like a producer, you earn it all the time. So that's my social. We're working on things. Got a couple films we're excited about. Got a couple TV projects we're excited about. Nothing really plug other than Quarantine, which is what we made. And it's on IGTV. Mm-hmm. But we're looking to try to move that to another, a bigger platform and maybe get the season 2 or season 3 out of it.
Nice.
But as always, it's like what's in front of me right now and hopefully what's in front of me next month. Hopefully I'm in Venice. You know, that'd be incredible.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
The Venice Film Festival, that'd be great fun to go to. But
when is it? Yeah. September 2nd? Is that when it starts?
2nd to the 12th. Yeah.
So 2nd
to the 12th.
You got a pretty tight turnaround if they're going to, because the 2nd's like next Wednesday, dude, or Tuesday.
Yeah, Wednesday. I can't do the 14-day quarantine. So I'd have to get the exception from the minister. But it's on the table. It's all on the table, man.
Fingers crossed. We'll see what happens.
I do think if I had one thing to say to everybody, it'd be like, just know that I think there are a lot of people going through rough times during this pandemic. Check in on people, you know. Not everyone has a million friends. No, not every kid is happy. And I worry about that. And I think that is, and I think you mentioned earlier, going to be the long-term effect of this entire situation. We're making the best of it, it seems. You know, I'm making the best of it. Business is thriving. And overall, I'm pretty happy. But it's challenging. And if it's challenging me, I'm sure it's challenging a lot of other people out there. So, yeah, check in on people, man.